Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code SPOTIFY for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
This episode is brought to you by Reese's Peanut Butter Cups. In breaking news, leading scientists worldwide are conducting experiments to determine if Reese's Peanut Butter Cups are the perfect combination of peanut butter and chocolate. However, it appears the study was inconclusive, as the scientists couldn't help but eat all the Reese's. Because when you want something sweet, you can't do better than Reese's. Find Reese's now at a store near you.
If you're an athlete, you know the greatest motivator of all is the fear of letting your teammates down. After all, a team is only as good as its weakest link. So you owe it to those wearing the same jersey as you to be your best every time you step on the field. That's why there's no vape in team. When you vape, you can expose your lungs to toxic chemicals that can damage your lungs. If you're a step behind, the team's a step behind. Brought to you by The Real Cost and the FDA.
Hello, everyone. I am Ben Johnson, and this is the Perpetual Chess Podcast. Perpetual Chess is a weekly interview show where top chess players, authors, content creators, and accomplished amateurs discuss their careers and share stories and chess improvement tips. Perpetual Chess is a part of the Blue Wire Podcast Network, and we'd like to give special thanks to our presenting chess education sponsor, Chessable.com. For more information about the show, you can go to PerpetualChessPod.com. But without further ado, let's get to the show. Hello, everyone, and welcome back to Perpetual Chess. We are joined this week by a guest who is a distinguished guest from sort of outside the chess world, but also very in the chess world. He is an author, a psychology professor at the Queens College of the City University of New York. He specializes in late-life depression and cognitive impairment. He's also a practicing clinical psychologist. He's an avid chess player, if you're wondering why he's on a chess podcast. He began tournament chess as an adult, age 33, and has reached the USCF 2000, which used to be called Expert. It's a bit more confusing now, but I still think of it as USCF Expert. He's a chess author and frequent collaborator with Grandmaster Boris Gokko. They had a series called Lessons with a Grandmaster, which is very highly regarded. And their latest book is Analyzing the Chess Mind, which I just read, new this year from Quality Chess, which also goes deep into chess psychology, but also has lots of chess improvement advice from Grandmaster Gokko. And I'm excited to welcome to the show Dr. Joel Sneed. Welcome, Joel.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, exciting. You come highly recommended by Kostya Kavutsky. What's your relationship with Kostya?
Just, was fortunate enough to that he was willing to teach me a little bit. So we had some lessons together. And, trying to improve my game, I've had lessons with a lot of strong players trying to improve my game. He was one of them, and I thought he was fantastic. And I think what they're doing at the Chess Dojo is fantastic. And so he was, kind enough to put me in touch with you.
Great. Yeah. And not to put any pressure on you, Joel, but Kostya said that you're funny.
I don't think I'll be funny today, but I'll try to be.
All right, we'll see. but aside from the Chess Dojo talk, which of course I agree with you, they're doing fantastic work. I wanted to start with your chess origins, because we were just chatting a bit before we hit record, and I don't always... A lot of chess origin stories I find to be broadly similar. A lot of us learn chess from our parents and get tossed into the tournament arena one way or another. But you have a pretty unique chess tournament origin story. Do you mind sharing it with our listeners, Joel?
Sure. As I said, I learned how to play at 24, I guess it was. I think it was around 24. I remember I used to play my father-in-law, and we were both quite bad, and I learned the rules a little bit, And then I didn't play again for another 5 or 6 years. And I was interning, you know, when you do a PhD in psychology, the final step in the clinical psychology PhD is an internship at a hospital, a psychiatric hospital. And I was at Bellevue Hospital, and I was treating a 10-year-old kid. And at the office that I was in, there was a chessboard. Just, you know, they have many times when you treat kids, you have games to play to sort of break the ice and to have something to do while you're talking with kids. And so checkers and chess and those types of things. And he said, you know, looked over at the shelf and said, why don't we play chess? And I said, okay, I knew the rules of the game. So we started to play. And we played for, you know, 3 or 4 months together. And when I finished my internship, I did a postdoc in statistics at NYU, in math and statistics at NYU. And NYU, for those who don't know, is situated in the West Village of New York City, and right around the corner from NYU was a very cool, famous shop called the Chess Shop, and it was on Thompson Street. And local people in New York will remember it, at least the old timers. And I started to go, and it was back when there was smoking, and God, it was just a cloud of smoke and old people drinking coffee, and I would come out with migraines, but I loved it.
Yeah,
I just loved to play there. And so I went every lunch break, you know, every day at lunch, and took lessons from Richie Gilmartin and even David Canty, who's a regular at the Marshall still. And I've known him now for 20 plus years. And we just started the whole thing and met my friend Uri Feld there. And it was just sort of a chess thing, you know, and then we went to, got the courage up to play a tournament game at the Marshall. And that was we went to, the U.S. Amateur Team East tournaments and that kind of stuff. That was the early days.
Nice. Yeah. And again, for listeners, so at age 33, he played his first tournament and made it to over 2,000. And it's pretty slow and steady progress. It's kind of the dream for a lot of people, I think, who listen to this podcast. And you've written, Joel, that you learn a lot. Part of the reason that you've put this time into chess, obviously pretty successful outside of chess and a lot going on, is that you learn a lot about yourself. So what has this experience taught you about yourself over the years?
Oh, that I'm extremely obsessional and...
If you didn't know that already, right?
I didn't know that. Would you just sort of repeat the same mistakes over and over again, expecting different results, right?
Right.
Yeah, I mean, that was one of the great things that Boris said, actually, in our first, the very beginning of, I think it's the introduction of the first Lessons with Grandmaster book. He said, paraphrasing, but basically he said, chess always corrects your self-assessment. And he had the complete opposite situation. He felt like he was overly confident. And of course, we're talking about, you know.
If I were Boris Golko, I'd be overconfident.
I'd be overly confident too. Yeah. Yeah. But he had, you know, he was this is USSR 19, you know, mid 70s, right? And he felt like he was overly confident. And he said this really important thing, like chess always corrects your self-assessment. And so, you know, that started me thinking about, like, well, the chess psychology of it, like how much of us is in this game, you know, because I don't think I was, that was not what I was attracted to when I started playing. I was attracted to it because I liked the beauty of end games, you know, like that, you know, I find the aesthetics of end games and the mathematics of material, you know, to be, you know, I find that the, you know, and the logic And Smyslov talks about that in his book, right? He talks about the beauty, the truth in the chessboard. And I feel like, okay, if I'm winning by a piece, I'm going to win the game. Like, that's it. It's over. That's not, of course, the truth, because there are other factors. But I just really loved that part of it. And I've been reflecting a lot recently about this idea about chess being science and art and sport, and the sport part of it I really don't like. I just don't care for winning for winning's sake. You know, I want the game to be, you know, something that I've done well, or I don't want something pretty in it, or
aesthetically pleasing. That's nice. Yeah, sorry to cut you off. I've noticed some people have that mindset, and some people come from a more sort of Street Fighter perspective where they enjoy the competition. And I've noticed that people who like the artistic element more, which obviously I certainly understand, they can be more easily steered away from tournament chess. Do you like, as opposed to just enjoying the game, reading books and stuff like that? Does that ring true to you, Joel?
Well, I certainly find the competition part of it unpleasant. I feel like it's the Ulf Anderson school, right? You just had that great podcast with Ulf Anderson, which was fantastic to finally hear from him.
Yeah,
he's like very hard to find. I've tried to find him because I, you know, obviously like that kind of chess, and I just want to like have a cup of tea and sit and think about stuff for a really long time. So there's this thing in psychology, we call it need for cognition. And it's just, it's you know, people that, like me, and I would imagine a lot of people in chess, you know, like to analyze, right? Like to think and solve problems. Like, it's fun, it's enjoyable, just that. So we would all score high on need for cognition. And that's what Ulf is talking about in that interview. He's talking about how pleasant and enjoyable it is to think, put your head in your hands and think about a position for a really long time, and like shorter time controls and the sport of it. Just, you know, and it's just stressful. Like he says, it's stressful and it's not enjoyable. So when I play tournament games, what I struggle with, win or lose, is that I never want to experience what I experienced that night again. So every year it's like, oh my God, that was terrible. Win or lose. Like, I win games and I was like, that was horrible. I don't want to experience what I just experienced, even if I've won the game, because it was stressful. So stressful to win the game. There's always a clock, but, you know, there's always time pressure now. You know, you don't win with half an hour on your clock anymore. It's a time scramble always. And it's just, you know, very stressful now. Yeah. And it used to be much more, you know, okay, so maybe there's some age factor going on there that, you know, that he was talking about, that it's just less pleasant to be involved in that.
Yeah, I can certainly relate to that, having had a tournament with some challenges, as I alluded to recently. I didn't mention in the Dean tournament, I did manage to win my last three games, so I avoided abject disaster, but it brought home the lesson. And I was talking about this with my friend and friend of the pod, Evan Rosenberg, when I was 0-3. Like, even for me, and I totally get that feeling of unpleasantness, but I also, like, I find the ability to concentrate so redemptive that it keeps me coming back. But but nonetheless, the bottom line is the highs are not nearly as high as the lows are low. And I've heard a lot of chess players lament that.
Right. Well, it's like remembering the things you do wrong on a test.
Right.
Right. You don't remember the 95 questions you got right. You remember all the ones you got wrong, or you think you got wrong. Yeah. We had the same tournament experience. I lost those three games, and then I managed to win the last three, but boy, it was terrible.
Yeah. So to set the stage for listeners, so Joel has been playing when circumstances can allow over the past 18 years of tournaments, and has gone from, his first rating was about 1200, and he made it over 2000 USCF. but his last tournament was in May of this year, and Joel had been telling me he had a rough tournament. He went 0-3, so now there's a bit of a crisis of conscience about what to do next. So while that's going on, Joel, are you still taking lessons and do you have a foot in the chess world?
Oh yeah. I'm doing lots of stuff. I'm still taking lessons. I play all the time. I'm working on a couple of different chess projects. I don't know if this is a good time to talk about some of those. I'm working on a couple of different projects. I'm writing a book on the Caro Kann with Keith Arkell,
cool.
Grandmaster Keith Arkell in Britain, and I think I'm starting to, which I was going to talk to you, but not necessarily on the podcast about. I want to do like a YouTube series on a lesson with the Grandmaster of the series,
okay?
Because I've taken a lot of lessons with strong players. I really enjoy talking to really strong chess players about everything chess, and like you do, right? I mean, you get to do that too, but on an even higher level, talking to world champions and stuff. But I really enjoy that, and taking lessons from them and getting their perspective and their opinions and their advice. So I've met with and talked with a lot of really good players, and I thought, why not turn that into a YouTube series, and we'll just, a continuation of the lessons with a grandmaster idea, and put it up on YouTube, and let people see. Maybe the people that I'm talking to, they'll be like, I really like the way that guy taught, or I like that guy's perspective or his repertoire. Maybe I'll contact him, and so it could be a way to talk about books that are coming out, or coaches that are less well known. I think a lot of people see people on streaming and Twitch and all that kind of stuff, and there are about 10 or 15 of these famous people, but there are like hundreds of really, really strong chess players in the world that that you can go see and talk to, and get coaching advice and stuff from.
Yeah, I mean, someone like Boris Golko, who, to be clear for any newer listeners, an absolute legend, U.S. champion, and played in candidate cycles, and, wrote in your first book about, coming up with playing against Karpov and all these Soviet era legends. But someone like him, he's pretty off the radar these days. He does his collaborations with you. But as far as I know, he doesn't have a big online footprint. I know he emigrated to the U.S., but I don't know where he lives or anything like that. And there's so many just incredibly accomplished and brilliant people.
That entire era. Romanishin lives in Ukraine. Mm-hmm. Faganyan. Belyavsky,
right?
There are all these phenomenal chess players, top 10 chess players from the 80s that are probably 65 now, 70, and we're talking world-class players. We're talking about people at the level of Nakamura and to 30 years ago, and they have a lot to offer, amazing amount to offer.
Yeah, and of course, Golko has the insane story of the prime years of his chess career being robbed, from
32 seven years.
Yeah, from age 32 to 39 to not be able to compete because he was trying to get out of the Soviet Union, and therefore they weren't inviting him to tournaments. I mean,
that's how I met him. My father-in-law and my wife's family were also in the same boat, refuseniks in the former Soviet Union. And that's how I met him. I met him through my father-in-law.
Oh, and, wow. So not a chess connection? Or
not? No, synagogue.
Wow, right. That's how you meet Golko,
I think so. He's like, I think I remember that. He's like, I sit next to him at the synagogue. And so he put me in touch with him. But I think Boris lives in Israel now.
Okay.
There's all those legends from, they're around. I mean, not all of them are, Ulf Anderson, for example, is not very approachable. because he, you know, doesn't have internet, and I have to go train in some cave in Sweden somewhere.
I love it. Yeah, so analog. It's beautiful.
You can't bring an electronic clock. It has to be the old one with the wind up in the back.
Right, but of course, in our interview, he's like, these computers, they're useful. You know.
Great.
Shout out to Ulf Anderson if you catch word with that. Obviously, a honor of a lifetime to get to chat with him, but you admire the purity for sure.
Yeah, it's my favorite player. Yeah, what a great player.
Yeah. So bringing it back to your tournament chess, because I want to get sort of more broadly into chess psychology as the conversation goes on, Joel. So you had a rough tournament and you haven't been motivated to play since then. That's something I think a lot of listeners will find relatable. Me too. So if you had a friend contact you and say they were in that situation, but they did want to play again, in theory, like, what would you advise them?
You know, it's just a symptom of obsessional doubt, right? I mean, that's essentially what it is. And, you know, the answer is very, very simple. So when I work with my patients, I have a saying that I repeat hundreds, if not thousands of times, and that is approach, don't avoid. And it's the single most useful thing that you can do to treat any kind of anxiety, right? And I think that this falls under a fear that I talk about in the chapter on improving your chess psychology about fear of losing, right? I think it's the quote from, well, anyway, there's a quote in the book that you move from, oh, John Watson, right. Cy sent me an article from like 1981, an interview with John Watson. And he says something about moving from being interested in chess, like in the exploration of chess, to being afraid of losing. And it has something to do, I think, with the meaning of the rating points in our mind, in our unconscious, that has something to do with our status and how we feel about ourselves and our self-esteem. And when all of that is on the line, and it is for a lot of people, you know, and your intelligence too, right? Like, I think there's a huge amount, especially mostly in chess, or peculiarly in chess, right? Where somehow your chess is connect, you know, like when you meet someone, you say, oh, you play chess, you must be smart. Like, it's the, and anytime they want to like talk, they want to show, in literature and art and movies and everything, they want to convey someone thinking. It's like there's a chessboard around. And so we identify somehow in our minds with this idea that, you know, chess makes us smart or is somehow connected with being smart. And when you have some doubt about how smart you are, and I certainly do, all of that's on the line when I play.
Right.
And that's a lot. Like, it's just a game, but it's not. And it's connected. I disagree with most of everything that Ruben Fine wrote about in his chess psychology book as a psychoanalyst. But the connection between the pieces in the game and your unconscious and what's going on in your unconscious is very true. Like, that's right up front and center. So I think that trying to acknowledge being honest with yourself about, being honest with yourself about what's at stake can be helpful in terms of, getting yourself back into it. And I think in that, you know, this hypothetical friend, you know, I would say approach, don't avoid. And that's what I tell myself. You know, I tell myself, okay, it's time to, you know, time to get back into it. And you just have to, it's like a cold shower. You just have to do it, you know, and prepare yourself a little bit, start doing some tactics, you know, and just get back in there. But I have so much obsessional doubt about, you know, my game, my openings, my this, my that, that it's just very, very difficult for me to finally pull the trigger and get in there again.
Yeah. And for me, it often feels like it's like going to the gym when you're not, when it's out of your routine, it's easy to just push back. Like, I always feel like I need some runway if I'm going to actually pursue tournaments. I'm not one of these people who I've learned that I can't be one of these people that just shows up every 6 months, because the results are going to be so bad that it's going to deter me from wanting to show up again. Whereas if I'm competing regularly, then the results start to move at least in the right direction. But
yeah, you have to be in form.
Yeah.
And you don't, and you have to play yourself. I mean, I've had many lessons where the stronger player in the lesson, right, the teacher, would be, oh, this is just, you're just in bad form.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Yeah.
Like even just practical stuff, like being up a piece and converting a game, you know, and that kind of stuff. Not that that's easy to do, but you know, it's easier when you're in practice and you're in practical, you've been playing, you know, regularly. Tournament games, like there's a whole nother, it's not this online stuff.
Yeah, it's just a whole different animal. All right, Well, Joel, we have one related Patreon mailbag question. Listeners who support Perpetual Chess are able to send in questions. We haven't had a lot of questions lately, so I'm glad to have a few good ones for Joel, and always good to have the support of generous Perpetual Chess listeners. And this one is from longtime friend, supporter of the pod, Tyron Ross Price, who on these notes asks if you could share any tips for getting into a beneficial mindset before a tournament. And you write about this some in the book, which, by the way, the book is fantastic. And as Joel alluded to, his chapter about psychology, some of the chapters are game analysis by Grandmaster Goko, which, of course, are also great, but more in the traditional chess manual mindset, although there is a psychological angle to them. But Joel's chapter is worth its weight and available on Forward Chess. But anyway, do you need me to repeat Tyron's question after that long digression, Joel?
He asked about
beneficial
mindset. Yeah, I do talk about that in the book. I mean, there are stuff that there are things that I've done that, I mean, I don't honestly know if they are helpful, but things that I have picked up on over the years. Just talking to strong players, getting, you know, well, what do you do, and all that kind of stuff. As probably clear, like I get pretty anxious before the games that when I go to play tournament games. Like, it's not really a comfortable experience. So I'm pretty up and intense and jacked up on adrenaline, and so I have to learn how to kind of calm down. And I find having like a regular routine to be very helpful. So like just showing up at a tournament that you've never been to before, you know, not being aware of the surroundings, not knowing where the tournament hall is, where you're going to play, what board you're on, all that stuff, you know, keeps you from kind of focusing on the game and your mindset. And so I prefer to do a lot of rehearsal, and I talk about this with patients all the time, especially patients with social anxiety that suffer from, you know, the anxiety of sort of the crippling anxiety of feeling like they're being evaluated by people that they're talking to. So when I work with people like that, I emphasize a lot about rehearsal that I think is very useful. Like when I used to give talks in psychology when I was young. You know, you have to get up in front of a couple of hundred people and deliver a research talk, and you're always terrified that there's going to be some genius in the audience who's going to just tear your research apart. And it's a terribly anxiety provoking experience, especially when you're young. And you know, now it's much less anxiety. And I imagine that's true for the same for, like, you know, experienced chess players, right? Much less anxiety for them to play chess. So there's something to that, right? So the more you do it, the less anxiety there will be, and you can calm down and focus on your game. But what I was saying about those talks, those psychology talks, was, you know, I used to do a lot to prepare for them, right? I would practice my talk. I would go to the venue to make sure I knew where it was. I would, if I could, you know, I'd even get in there and put the talk up on the screen when the room is empty, and just kind of run through my talk. And so, and sort of just be in the room where I was giving the talk. And I think you can use that as a kind of a metaphor for chess preparation, right? So you preparing yourself, there's the perennial stuff, like, are my openings intact, and have I been doing my tactical training, and have I been playing regularly, that kind of stuff. But then there's the, you know, just the logistic stuff about the playing conditions and the hall and your routine, like where are you, what's your setup going into the game that day? Is it like, are you running around, you know, picking up the kids and getting them to daycare or off to school or to their after school program, and then, you know, getting in the car and going there and there, and then, you know, getting dinner ready and then running off to the tournament where you haven't had a minute to think. And then you get to the tournament and you're like, okay, it's like, let's play a chess game. Your mind is not in it, you know? So I think there's a lot of useful stuff in terms of being in a good mindset for playing, where in terms of the sort of the practical stuff, not just the chess stuff. Having a routine reduces anxiety about all those things that I was just talking about. You go to the same coffee shop, get the same coffee. You already have your, let's say you're playing a real, like, 4-hour game or something like that. You might need some kind of mid-game snack of some kind. I always remember Boris said someone used to like chocolate. Maybe it was Smyslov or Tal or something like that. So I always bring chocolate with me to, you know, in the 2 hours into the game, I have a piece of chocolate, you know, that kind of stuff. And I remember Boris telling me not to eat too much, like, don't eat a big dinner and then go play because you get sleepy and all that kind of stuff. So, you know, those are like little practical things. And then in the book, I talk about chess, I talk about visualization exercises. And this is exactly kind of what the question, you know, to answer that, a part of answering that question would be having the time to think about your what you're just about to do. Like, can you sit down kind of in a meditative way and like walk yourself through what's going to happen? You're at the board. Who's your opponent? You know, they say, okay, you can start your clocks. You shake your hands. You have your coffee. You've got your chocolate. You know, like, and you really kind of walk through it. When you get to the board, you've already been there, you know, you're already there. Yeah. And that I think is, you know, a level of concentration and preparation that goes well beyond just, you know, I'm ready, my openings are up and I've been playing, you know.
Great advice. Yeah. But I know it can be challenging because, like, Tyron, I know you live in North Jersey, you're able to play in your local chess club, you play at the Marshall frequently, so you often would know the surroundings, but I think for a lot of people it's more like weekend getaways,
right?
And in that case, how could you adapt it if you're like, so you're getting there that morning, you know?
Yeah, no, that's exactly the point about the chess talk, the psych talks that I would give. So the conferences that I'm talking about, these are national conferences that are always in sort of big cities, San Francisco, LA, and Toronto, and you know, some use Puerto Rico, maybe if you're lucky, Philadelphia, Washington, D.C., Boston, New York, right? So that's exactly what I'm talking about. You're in a strange city. So how do you prepare yourself? You get there early, right? You scope out the scene. Go to the tournament place. It's at a hotel probably. Go to the hotel. Where am I going to be playing? Where's the closest Starbucks? Where am I going to get my, you know what I mean? Like, you get all of that stuff and go and like put yourself in it, rehearse it. This is really about rehearsal, and get yourself in it so that when it's time to do it the next day, you've been there and you know, oh, I know where I am. I've been here before. I know where the Starbucks is. I know where my tournament is. I know where to look for this person and that thing and this thing. And I'm set up and ready, and I can focus on playing.
Okay. And do you have a philosophy, Joel, on like cramming opening lines if you find out who you're playing, say? I mean, obviously, if you have hours, I think it's reasonable to prepare. But what if you have 15 minutes, 20 minutes?
It's never helped.
Yeah, it really doesn't.
I've done it. I'm like, oh, this guy, he plays X or she plays that. Doesn't matter, you know. Yeah. I don't feel like it doesn't. And the times that I've... And I have found that, and this may just be peculiar to New York City chess, like playing at the Marshall or at my local club, I find that the preparing for a specific opponent rarely works, just because there's so many variables that you always end up paired with someone that was not the person you're prepared for. You're like,
yep.
So I, you know, that doesn't mean that preparation is no good. It's preparation that you'll use another time. But, you know, I have rarely prepared my openings for a specific person and have that be the pairing for that evening.
Yeah.
You know, it's happened like a couple of times, and both times I probably lost. So I don't know.
I can relate. All right. Well, we're going to discuss some more common chess psychological pitfalls, but first we're going to take a break and hear from our sponsors. I've been due for an update from our friends at aimchess.com. Aimchess, of course, gathers games from the major chess playing sites and gives you actionable intel of what aspects of your game to work on, and it helps you work on them. I've been working on some new openings in my Blitz game. It turns out I'm doing pretty decently with those new openings. Of course, I've got to keep them a secret from you guys. But I still have some other things to work on. Time management slightly better, but lots and lots of room to improve. I also need to work on advantage capitalization and resourcefulness. On the other hand, my end games are doing well and my openings are doing well overall. So if you're looking for that kind of insight, as well as puzzles of tactics that you missed and chances to practice positions you didn't convert, then try out aimchess.com. If you do so, please use the code perpetual30 at aimchess.com. The link is also in the show description.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
And we are back, and we are going to go straight to the next Patreon mailbag question. This one I and Joel both found relatable, but we'll get to it. So Igor Feinstein, thanks for supporting the pod, Igor. He says, I'm a strictly online chess player, and the vast majority of the time I play bullet chess. I fully acknowledge that it adds no serious dimension to my chess, but I convince myself that it's a type of training tool to train myself to think and calculate faster. However, I've been discovering over and over again that I'm very quick to go on serious tilt after losing just a couple of games. Recently, I went on a tilt that cost me 150 rating points in one sitting. if I want to continue playing bullet chess without suffering psychological harm like my epic tilts, what do you recommend is the best approach? Should I limit myself to a certain number of games per day? Should I bother analyzing my own games even though most of my mistakes are in a time scramble? Should I take some time in between games, especially after losing? And what is the ultimate psychological reason chess and poker players go on tilt? Are GMs known for going on tilt? End of question. So much resonates. So eager to hear your take.
Well, first of all, the entire game is a time crunch, right?
Yeah, so bullet. Yeah.
You start off in time pressure, right? I don't. You know, honestly, I don't think this is a chess question. More. I mean, what I'm hearing is more in the realm of kind of like video game addiction, gambling addiction, that kind of stuff. I think what I'm hearing is more about getting the next fix from playing, you know, that next dopamine shot from playing your next bullet game. And so when that's the case, I don't think the latter part of those questions, they're the logical part of the mind saying, yes, there are things that you can do. Should you take a break? Should you try to, have a session instead of just sort of an open-ended session, but like, say, I'm going to play for an hour and put on a timer. There are all kinds of logical things that you can do, and I think that the person that wrote the question and most chess players are smart enough to know or to even experiment with sort of logical efforts. I have struggled with this. I mean, ever since I started playing online, which I have to say is I think, you know, I'm not happy about it. I thought that chess was a lot better when I was just sitting there reading my system, you know, like there was, you know, before I learned about the ICC, you know, this is a long time ago, but you know, that's what I did, right? I would come home from work, it'd be 6-7 o'clock, I'd have dinner, and then I would sit for 3 hours and I would study my system or reassess your chess or Irving Chernev, you know, those type of things. And I would study and that's how I got good. I'd study hard and now I just like get on and play blitz, right? So the latter part of the question has to do with sort of logical attempts to deal with what I think of more as a dopamine fix. And I think that and it goes. I'm not saying that like I don't have that. I mean, I get that too all the time. I don't do bullet, but I play 5-minute blitz games and 150 rating points. Sure, all the time. Right. You know, I'm terrible, and I even know what it's about, and I still do it. I think this is kind of perennial issue for chess players. And, you know, it's one that I've thought a lot about. I do think it's more in, you know, if you look at the literature on video game addiction and gambling and stuff like that, you'll see a very close parallel for what this person is talking about, what we experience as chess players playing these games. We go on tilt because we're bent out of shape, and we're these games put you in a very heightened adrenaline rush state, and that can be positive and negative, right? So when you're feeling good, the pieces are moving, you're feeling like, you know, things are going good, you're getting your dopamine fix. Great, you know, you're doing it, but then you lose and you get negative and you try to make up for your points and you try to, you know, that, and you start to feel the pressure and you start hating yourself and blah 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 and what an idiot I am, and then that snowball starts to go, and you know, you're in this sort of cycle And that's what poker's called, tilt. And the easiest way to deal with that is to turn the computer off, you know. And he's already answering his questions. The logical right. part of it is there, but this isn't about logic. This is about emotion and how we feel, and the relationship between these online type of games where there's time pressure, and the time pressure gives you this sort of dopamine burst. We're like little rats in a cage pressing a bar for our next fix of cocaine. You know, that's essentially what's happening. Is it good for your chess? No, I mean, to begin with, I don't think there's a chess player I've talked to, and you've talked to hundreds, but I would bet you that not a single one of them has said, yeah, bullet's great for your chess. He says that bullet's not good for his chess, so he already knows that it's not good for his chess. I haven't played bullet myself ever. But even the faster games. But I mean, I think at five minutes with a few seconds delay is actually a time control you can learn a little bit from. So if you go over a 5 minute game with a good player, you'll be able to see patterns that you would see in your slower games.
Yeah.
So well, I would three two maybe be the fastest I would do. So that's what, if it was about improving chess, I would go below 3-2.
Yeah, well, good advice, Joel. And yeah, as I said, I'm as you have, as Igor, the questioner has, I've struggled with this stuff, and for me the answer had to be cold turkey. I can't play bullet. I can't regulate my emotions in bullet. For more on this, I also interviewed Dr. Jana Krivets a year and a half ago, something like that. She's also a psychologist, and we talked about these issues as well. But there's no easy answers. It's still, as you say, Joel, I now play 3 minute or longer, and it'll happen to me now like 1 out of 20 times, usually around like anchoring to some rating that just sets me off. But if it's a bullet session, if I sit down to play 5 1-minute games, it'll happen like half the time or something. So
and
it does set up these cycles of addiction where you end up staying up late, and the self-loathing that comes with that, and it's just you know
it's terrible.
It's painful, but tough to change at that moment. You've got to do the change like away from when it's happening.
A neighbor of mine played bullet, and I remember I saw him in the hallway, and he's like, I just finished 8 hours of bullet. And I was just like, and I played him, I only played him once, and like he didn't really know, like there was some fundamental problems in his chess, like positionally, just like it was just not very good. And this was at a time where I don't know how good I was at that time. This was 10, 12 years ago. So I don't remember how good I was. Maybe I was 16, 17, 18. I don't know. I can't remember. But I was better than he was, just sort of like understanding and positional chess, you know. And I think he won the game just throwing lots of pieces at me in a quick game. But I just remember that. I just finished 8 hours of bullet chess. Like, I can't imagine that's healthy, right? Like, it's just not. And I think that happens to people. You know, I certainly have played several hours, playing blitz. So the calmer you can be, the less involved you can make the adrenaline, because it's about adrenaline and dopamine hits and that intensity that comes with pressure is what's driving the psychology there. And so the slower you play, which is what Ulf, going back to what Ulf said, right? The slower you play, the less stress there is, because you can sit and think and enjoy. But once you get the clock going, you start to panic. You get that adrenaline rush hitting the clock, and that's when it gets tricky psychologically.
For sure. Yeah. Well, Igor, sorry, we don't have any easier answers.
Yeah, it's a deeper psychology question. It's not a, it, yeah. it, you know, it's it's not a chess question so much. As far as I see it, I think chess players, and I've talked to people about this, the strong players who also have suffered from this, many do, and they have tended to focus on the latter part of those questions. And I don't think that, I think it's about the first part of the question and not the latter part. He's smart. He's a smart guy, Igor. So logical things, you can try logical things. I've tried all kinds of things. And I don't think any of those logical things help. They may help for a minute or a session or two, and then you relapse. I mean, I find it really more the analogy of drug addiction, video game addiction is even better. So read about those things and you'll see yourself. Mm-hmm. And that's what I've done.
But it sounds like you're saying the ultimate answer might be just not to play Bullet. Am I reading too much into your answer there?
At least, okay. At least Bullet.
Yeah. maybe just quit chess.
No, not that. But it's the clock, right? I mean, it's the adrenaline. That's what I'm getting at. It's the drug addiction. So, I mean, you know, so there's a neurophysiology going on here that is what I'm talking about. And so if you, essentially go back to the Narcotics Anonymous, Alcoholics Anonymous literature, what do they say? One is too many, a thousand, never enough. Mm-hmm. And that's the model I think that is most applicable here. And for most people that suffer from this, for me too. So if I don't play, this type of stuff, fast games, I do useful stuff for my chess. I start training. I go over GM games. I start calculating. I do tactics, right? Because I'm in recovery. but when I'm not, when I've relapsed, all I do is play Blitz. And you know, I'm just getting the next fix. And this guy's basically saying the exact same thing, and he'll probably just go in circles. So this is the kind of thing that, you know, I would rather treat as a patient, you know, and rather than, it's not a chess question, is what I'm saying.
Okay. Well, again, very helpful. And yeah, I think this will resonate with like 80% of the listeners.
Yeah. No, this is the one thing I want to talk about more than anything.
Yeah.
For your listeners and myself, like this is the thing that I've wanted to study from a research perspective. But you know, I mean, I've done it. I've gotten into this and the video game addiction model is the one to read about. If you want to read about yourself, read about video game addiction.
Any particular papers or books that come to
mind? Not off the top of my head, but when I got into it, because I wanted to study it, I wanted to start doing some studies and try to figure out what to do or if there's anything I could do. And, you know, I just got into the video game addiction literature, and that's where you'll see yourself, you know?
Okay. Okay. Well, on a related question, Joel, I hope I'm not stealing too much of the great material from your book, but one of your closing sentences was, most chess players do not realize that their psychology can be studied, but indeed it can, and the inner strength resulting from such study will pay great dividends over the board and in your life. So I was curious if you have any stories of, I mean, obviously there's highs and lows associated with it, but how do you feel that it has helped you away from chess?
Well, I don't know how it's helped me away from chess. I often have thought about that. It's possible that I think very, I feel like it's, you know, I've thought a lot about this because it's related to the question of can chess help certain types of psychological conditions, you know. For example, I did a study looking at the impact of chess on kids with attention deficit disorder, hyperactive disorder, ADHD, and I think that chess is a real potentially good treatment for ADHD. It it targets neuropsychologically, it targets all of the areas, neuropsychological areas that are awry in ADHD, and I think could be very, very helpful from a research standpoint. It becomes very difficult because you have to teach people how to play chess and, you know, that kind of stuff. But I think that it has certain potential benefits, like just from what you're exercising with your brain when you play chess. And I think one of the things that it does teach you is planning and calculation, right? And so I think that one of the things that I feel a lot more, what's the word? Logical? I don't know if it's logical, but I feel like I'm better at planning. You know, like if I have to map something out, like I push it to the end is better than I used to. You know what I mean? So I can, okay, well, we need to do this. We need to do that. Let's do this, that, and the other. And then this, and then what about that? And then it's just almost like you're analyzing a position in your mind, which is the thing in ADHD that's difficult, right? Executive functions are the deficit, the major deficit in ADHD. And that's a problem with planning and attention issues. And so chess is a real, like really targets that one thing. The other thing that I would say about this kind of thing is it goes back to Igor's question, right? If we take chess as a self-reflective exercise, then we can learn a lot, right? And that's mm-hmm. what, for example, Jesse Cry has been talking about for so long, about the importance of studying your own games. Right. If you do that seriously, which I've never done, but he's too busy. He's too busy to work with me. I tried talk to him, but you know, I've never done that. But seriously, but I think that, you know, if you treat and it goes back to what Boris said, right? That it will always correct your self-assessment. That's because what he was doing was the hard work of analyzing his games. I mean, you can imagine 1970 in the Soviet Union working with those types of players. You're going to be sitting there going over your games. Like, yeah. Really, that's going to be intense. Like they're GMs for a reason. And if you do that, then you're going to learn a lot. You're going to come to grips with yourself. I mean, that's what he talks about in when he talks about Karpov and Kasparov in their world championship match. They, you know, Kasparov, they, for him to equal the score and to salvage that first match, right? It was about getting into the mind of Karpov and learning about who he was as a person. And all of a sudden he starts to switch over. He starts to play the Queen's Gambit declined, right? And the match turns around. And that's the kind of self-reflective process that chess allows. It's a privilege. It's a psychoanalytic privilege, as far mm-hmm. as I'm concerned. And Socrates said that the unexamined life is not worth living. I fully agree with that as a psychoanalyst. And in my mind, I've always thought about that psychoanalysis, which, you know, I'm a psychoanalyst. You know, I've always thought about what a privilege it is to be able to sit for 45 minutes with an analyst for 4 days a week, which is what you do in psychoanalysis, and reflect on your life and think about who am I and what am I doing and why I do what I do. And that's the part that I've always done. That's like, sort of like the main thing I've done since I was young. And I find that chess is like the perfect game for that. Like,
well said. Yeah.
So if you have that opportunity, don't waste it, because it's really special.
Well said. All right. Well, we got a lot more to discuss, Joel. I want to get into books, both from the chess realm and the non-chess realm, as you reference in your latest book. But first, we need to take one more break, Joel, to hear from our sponsors. Perpetual Chess is proud to be brought to you in part by our presenting chess education sponsors, Chessable.com. Chessable, of course, uses spaced repetition to help you remember tactical patterns, opening sequences, whatever aspect of your game that you're working on, and they have a huge library of awesome courses. So whatever it is you want to work on, there's a good chance you can find something to help you on Chessable. Some of their latest includes a lifetime repertoires course on the London from Grandmaster Sahaj Grover and Srinath Narayanan. Now, I don't want you to play the London personally, but if you're going to do it, then this is a good learning resource. Grandmaster Alex Cholovich has a new course on Bobby Fischer's Endgames. Of course, the legend R.B. Ramesh's Improve Your Chess Calculation if you really want to challenge yourself. So there's always tons to check out from Chessable.com. They have lots of free courses to check out as well. So just be sure to go to Chessable, get a streak going, and see what they have to offer.
Judy was boring.
Hello.
Then Judy discovered Chumbacasino.com.
It's my little escape.
Now Judy's the life of the party.
Oh, baby, mama's bringing home the bacon.
Whoa, take it easy, Judy. The Chumba life is for everybody. So go to Chumbacasino.com and play over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
And we are back. And Joel, one of the books that you say resonated with you the most in your book is actually not chess related. It is called Golf is Not a Game of Perfect. So, and you reference that in comparison to various sports psychology books that you'd read. So my first question when I read this, because you don't mention golf anywhere else in the book, is are you even a golfer, or did you just read this from a chess perspective?
I love golf, but I don't play. I mean, it's in my family, like my grandfather and stuff played all the time. So I kind of grew up with it around, but it's not something, I mean, I've played a little bit, but not much. I watch it. You know, I'm a big Tiger Woods fan, and I remember watching Jack Nicklaus win Masters when I was a kid, and would watch with my grandmother and stuff. So I love the game. I think it's interesting, although Mark Twain said it was a good walk ruined.
Yeah, it's a great line.
It's one of the great ones.
Yeah.
What I thought was really interesting when I was writing the book with Boris and doing research on chess psychology, and I read those books, like the chess psychology books, I was like, wait a second, there's all these people. Chess is a sport, man. You're like, you're sitting there trying to, you know, win. It's just happening in your mind, but it's still, you know, there's all of this sporting element to chess. And no one is talking about sports psychology. And so I tried to take a little bit from the sports psychology literature. And I thought it was really, really helpful how even someone as accomplished, you know, as I think it was Bob Watson in the book talks about how important it is to train your psychology in golf. And I was like, wow, you know, and now that I think of, you know, you hear it more and more and more, especially in one-on-one games like tennis, right? Tennis would be another one. Every one of these top tennis players has a sports psychologist on their team. And you can see it, like when they talk about like who's in their players box with the players. I don't know if you follow tennis, but you like there's Rafa Nadal, and then they show his coach, and then they show his fitness guy, and then they show the nutritionist guy, and then there's the sports psychology person. Yeah. And it's true for all of them now. They all have their own like sports psychology person. Now, of course, Nadal is a, you know, the best player in the world and so on and so forth, but no one's doing that in chess, as far as I know. I mean, it's unclear whether, you know, Magnus and people like that can afford to have a chess, you know, to have a sports psychologist. But they have a lot to offer, you know. And one of the, and I thought that this whole concept of, you know, golf not being a game of perfect was, you know, there was so much to think about, like in that book, as it was, and apply it to chess and like goal setting and and dreaming big, I thought was really great. That was like have big dreams. That's great. Now, how do you get there? But to have them is really great, you know. And the idea of like, you know, what is your, you know, what is your true score? You know, I think of it as true score because I trained in psychometrics. But you know, what is your true ability? You know, how good can you be? You know, and it was very interesting when I played a tournament once, and I did well. And I remember I went to Boris's house and I had a lesson, and he, in his mind, kind of calculated my performance score, and it was 2200 or something like that, or 2150 or 2200, and he was like, "Yeah, you see, you can be master strength," and you know, that's, it's interesting that he was less interested or not interested at all in any kind of rating game or average rating, which I also talk about in that chapter. Like, the average rating is just telling you about average performance. But if you're interested in how good you can be, you know, hey, look at that. You just played a tournament, you did really well, and you were, you know, performing at a master level. You can be that on average, right? You just have, you know, you have to get there. So I thought that was, you know, that was really interesting. And they talk about that in a lot of, in a lot of these sports psychology books. They talk a lot about mentalization and goals and all that kind of stuff that you know, I think we need to bring, you know, for the chess improvers out there, not for the people that are already really good, but, you know, for the chess improvers, like, if you're trying to maximize your ability to improve in adulthood, then you got to put effort not just into chess, but how you improve.
Yeah.
You know, and to think through, like, how can I do that efficiently? I don't have time to be inefficient. So it has to be done, like, you know, it has to be done efficiently. And that includes all kinds of stuff. Like, how, for example, going back to Igor, how's that training plan working for you?
Right.
Right? Like, how is my training plan working? My training plan right now is non-existent. And how is that working for me? Well, it's not.
Yeah.
Right? So the smarter goal approach that I talk about in the book is like, well, reassess. Like, did you implement a training plan? And then reflect back on how's it going? Make adjustments. Keep going towards getting something that's working. Okay, what's not working? You know? And again, that has to do with this idea of chess and self-reflection. That doesn't work for me. Why doesn't it work for me? You know, that kind of thing. And you keep doing that, and you keep, you know, you keep paring it down. And I think at some point, as you know, you've said, look, playing bullet doesn't help for me. I can't do it. I can't stop the train once I get on it, right? And for me too, like, I can't do that. If I'm training, I'm not playing blitz. Like, just not happening, because I can't do both simultaneously. Because everything goes out the window. I got to know that can't be part of my training game. Playing blitz online, that's got to be my pre-training game, training preparation. And then it's like, okay, if I'm going to make a comeback, if I'm going to start playing again, the blitz is going to stop.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, a lot from there to follow up on. One thing I just wanted for listeners, it's come up on the pod periodically, so I think some of you are familiar with the concept of SMART goals, but it's also mentioned in Joel's book. It refers to a specific type of goal. It's an acronym, which stands for specific, measurable, achievable, relevant, time-bound. And then I mentioned to Joel via email that I hadn't heard the "er." There's an "er" added that Joel just mentioned at the end, which is evaluate and reassess, you said, Joel?
Right.
Yeah, which is obviously fantastic advice. So as you say, we all have ups and downs, Joel, when it comes to sticking with regimens. But one thing we haven't dug into too much is, like, you made this massive jump that so many people listening would like to emulate. I, you know, it sounds like We have a very sort of cerebral, big picture approach to chess improvement, which I'm sure helps. I'm sure living in New York City helps getting to compete without like having to jump through too many hoops. But when you are on a good regimen, what sort of stuff has helped you improve your game?
So when I'm on a good regimen and I'm training and I'm playing, really it's just playing, right? Because once you start to play, it's like this automatic thing kicks in. You're like, oh my God, I'm playing.
Yeah.
And it's like, right? It's amazing, yeah. Right?
It's everything to me. It's the more I try other stuff and then compete, it's everything.
So you play like a serious game or plan to play a serious game. Or start to play, you know, in regular tournament games, and everything kind of falls into place. And you just start training, like whatever, you know. I mean, I've got a whole wall full of books, like you do too, right? You know, like a whole bookshelves full of stuff and books that I want to read and study and pick any of them. It doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. Just pick one. And start studying. And you know, for example, what I have done, you know, is what everyone does, right? You do some tactics to improve tactical awareness. And then I really enjoy going over games. And I find, you know, like Aliekhine's games to be probably like the best, for me, the best game collection, because it's just about the right, I have a really, really visceral response to modern chess books and all of the engine analysis that goes in them. It's like so irrelevant to me and It has nothing to do with over the board decision making. And I find it to be like, I can't even look at the book anymore. So I really don't even focus on any books that are written after 2000 because they don't help. Think, you know, I don't care if he's right or not.
Right.
I don't care. Like, I could care less if the computer finds that h4, h5 wins the game or whatever. That's irrelevant. What's relevant is, you know, his thinking at the time in relation to that player. And it was good enough for him. It's going to be good enough for us. Don't worry about that the computer is now 800,000 points better than he was. That's not important. What's important is that he's a lot better than you. Mm-hmm. And he's a lot better than his opponent, and he's going to show you his games. And I find that that's the, you know, just enough analysis, sometimes a tiny bit overboard, but just enough analysis where I have to work. And I think that's really important. Like the idea, you know, like what I try to do is to calculate the variation in my head, and that's important sort of calculation training. So just going over the game over the board with actual pieces, and then when I get to the calculation, try to do the variation in my head. And if, you know, I struggle, and if I can't do it, then move the pieces on the board or skip the analysis because it's too much and it's irrelevant anyway. That to me is probably the thing that I feel puts me in game shape the best, because that's what you do over the board.
Yeah. Yeah, good advice. And you mentioned the Aliekhine compilation. What other favorite books do you have for us, Joel? I'm sure you've got a few written before 2000.
Yeah, only before 2000. besides Lessons with a Grandmaster.
Yeah, which are great, by the way.
They really are.
I'll cop to it. I've only read the first one. I've heard great things over the years, so I've had the ebook from Everyman that I bought, so I have it in Chess Base. As I mentioned before, I like having the books in Chess Base, so I've had that forever, and I only obviously dug into it in getting ready for this interview, but I read your new book in its entirety, but I do, it's a unique style, and I really enjoyed reading it, and as you say, you can play through games in those.
Yeah, I really like all three of those books. Obviously I got to write them, so I was asking the questions, and you know, and of course they're edited, so I seem even smarter over the board in the book than I actually am. But you know, I had a friend of mine, you know, I was playing, you know, he was going through the book, and he was like, you know, yeah, it's like, there I am, you know, like my questions are like the questions that he would ask, or the assumptions that I would make about a position, or just like ghost on the board and like leaving pieces on pre and in my analysis, you know, and just having how clearly they see the board, the kinds of moves that they, you know, oh, he would never go for that. Like, that's so important. We should really make sure we talk about that. This idea of the internalization of the teacher, the grandmaster, the psychoanalyst, we have to touch on that. But in terms of books, what I like to do is go through the games. What I really, really like more than anything is games, and then a reasonable amount of analysis that I can do in my head, ideally. That's the perfect balance. So actually, Neil McDonald, I think, does a really, really spectacular job of that. Probably the best of anyone in terms of like modern day writer. Like he has I forget the name of it, but he did a series with Everyman where something about legends or something like that, a positional legends, like with
Giants Carpo. Of Strategy.
Giants of Strategy.
It's so funny that you mentioned that, because I have a podcast coming out. We're recording this on Wednesday. It's coming out on Friday, where Carsten Hansen and I discuss underrated chess books, and that's one of the ones I named.
Giants of Strategy is just so good, right?
Yeah.
And he's got a lot of books like that. He's so good at that. Like, here's let's learn from this great game. And he doesn't get in the way of the game, but does show a few things that you can calculate on your own. And therefore, you get through the book. There's a high enjoyment quality to it. So you feel like you accomplished something. I just find like that those are great. I mean, obviously, the book that comes to mind in terms of like overall, like how to play chess, I think Reassess Your Chess by Silliman is really, if you haven't read that, that's a really good book to go through seriously, like with a board and work through.
Okay. But, yeah, I agree. I've said before, I should be clear, I don't want to contradict myself. Reassess Your Chess is not my absolute favorite, but it's very good. Okay. Well, Joel, there's so much more on my outline, but as I mentioned before, we're recording, you've got to go. My daughter's homesick today, so hopefully we can do a part two sometime.
I'd love to.
But any closing thoughts before we say our goodbyes? I mean, I'm sure you have a wealth of stories from all the strong players you've spoken with. Like, among other possibilities, does any of your conversations with, like, you mentioned you talked to friend of the pod David Smeridan, Kostya, is there anything that really stuck with you from all your conversations and lessons with stronger players?
They all say great things that stick with you, you know, at some point, you know. For example, I had lessons with Cy Lakdawala, who's a prolific chess author. I think he's been on your
has always entertaining
podcast, and you know, he said that my need to be perfect paralyzes me to inaction, you know, and like I think about that stuff, you know, like those are nuggets of, okay, he's from a chess perspective, he's tapping into a psychological problem about competition, right? And so I find that stuff to be really useful. I think, you know, there are a few things that I would like to mention before we end. One is this idea of the ego being a limited resource, and two is this idea of the internalization of the chess teacher or the psychoanalyst or whatever you want to call it. So I'll just say briefly,
sure.
Right? The idea of the ego being a limited resource, this is really, really important. I use this all the time with my patients. When we are at war with whatever, and that would be, you know, you could think of it as chess, life, psychopathology, whatever. You think about your mind as a battlefield, and you think about the forces that you have at your disposal. And you know, imagine yourself in the Civil War, and you've got the Union and the Confederate armies facing each other on a hilltop somewhere in Virginia, right? That's the mind, that's the image that I want you to have in your mind. What would be a beneficial strategy for that fight? Would it be to spread out your forces so that they cover the entire state line of Virginia? Or would you focus on the battlefield and trying to consolidate your forces so that you can protect the battlefield? And the idea there is that if you spread out your army to protect the entire state line, you're going to be weak, right? And you're not going to be able to withstand the fight. And so what happens, the idea of the ego being a limited resource, is that we don't enough, I think, appreciate, I mean, you talk about this a lot in pretty much every podcast. You mentioned this idea, but it's really important. We don't enough appreciate how much we're asking ourselves to do in terms of setting up realistic goals and stuff and training plans. I see all the time these training plans that people put up online, or in, you know, they're going to train this, they're going to do 6 hours a day, they're going to do 3 hours a day of this and blah, blah, right? And now if you don't have anything to do besides that, fantastic, great. But most of us have jobs and kids and so forth and careers. I mean, you know, for me, I'm a professor, I'm a researcher, I'm a therapist. You know, I've got kids, and at some point at 11 o'clock at night, maybe I'll get to sit down and do a little chess, you know? And the ego, which is managing all of that, it's unrealistic to think that I'm going to get, you know, and under those circumstances, that I'm going to, you know, pop up with a fresh mind and do hard chess work, yeah, like analyzing games or analyzing positions or do, you know, doing that kind of thing. It's unrealistic for me to think that. It's the same kind of thing that happens with people. Bulimia is a kind of an eating disorder where there's a problem with sort of the ideal body image that exists in the person's mind and how they're going to get there. So they wake up and they're like, I'm going to starve myself today because I want to reach this ideal state where I look a certain way. They starve themselves. And then eventually they get too hungry, they get too tired, right? They get wiped out from work, and then they break down. And when they break down, they binge, right? And that is an idea and a model that you can apply to yourself in chess and in your chess training. If you think that your chess training plan is realistic, then, you know, or for me, like my chess training plan, like I'm going to do some serious training at 11 o'clock at night and I've got to wake up at 7:30 in the morning to get the kids ready for school. It's not going to happen, right? So you have to be realistic about your goals. And you have to think about the ego being a limited resource, because what will happen is that you'll end up beating yourself up, right? Which is what happens with the bulimic patients, right? You know, you end up beating yourself up that you're not able to meet the goals and the standards that you have for yourself, which are unrealistic to begin with. So that's the idea of the ego as a limited resource. And the last final thing I want to say about the teachers, and especially someone like Boris, someone that you can see and go see repeatedly who becomes your teacher, is that they, and I think this happens even with reading a book of a great, why people get good studying game collections is because that person becomes internalized in your mind the way a psychoanalyst becomes internalized in your mind when you see them regularly every day, 4 days a week, or a psychologist once a week. What would my therapist say? What would my teacher say? What would Boris say? Get answers to those questions. Boris would never put his rook behind that stupid pawn passively. He would sacrifice the pawn and activate his rook. You know what I mean? Like, that's the kind of thing that you get to take with you when you meet and study with a strong player, is that they're kind of on your shoulder with you. And that improves your ability to play.
That resonates. Yeah. As I've mentioned before on the pod, I've only had a coach in this most recent spate of tournaments these past 2 years. And the number of times that I think, like, I'm going to have to show this game to Axel, Grandmaster Axel Bachmann, it's like off the charts. And it helps because he's, you know, as I've mentioned before, and it's different for every person, but in my particular case, like, you know, when I have an advantage, I need to play more aggressively. So like in those situations, his voice is like ringing in my head, and that's hugely valuable, you know?
Yeah.
Awesome. Well, Joel, Coaster was right. This has been fantastic. Really appreciate you sharing your insights. Totally understand the struggle, but I'm sure there'll be some people rooting for you to make it back to the board at some point.
It's going to happen. I feel it.
Nice. Glad to hear it.
Yeah.
So obviously I'll link to the books. Is there anything else, I should link to in terms of, people who want to cheer you on?
No, I think that's great.
Okay, great. Well, you know, like I said,
if someone, you know, if they want to ask me questions or something, they can send me an email. That's fine. prof.sneed@gmail.com.
Okay, awesome. All right. Well, this has been fantastic. Like I said, and yeah, hope to get an update at some point down the road. And also, you know, we're not too far away, so hopefully we meet in person.
Yeah, that would be great.
Okay.
Maybe at the Marshall.
Exactly. All right.
Awesome. Okay. Very good.
Thanks a lot, Joel.
Okay. Take care.
Thanks to everyone who helps make Perpetual Chess possible. Big shout out to my producer, Matthew Passy. I'd also like to thank the Blue Wire Podcast Network, with whom we are proud to be affiliated. Be sure to follow us on social media, Beneficial1 on Twitter, @PerpetualChess on Instagram, or you can join the Perpetual Chess Facebook group. You can email me, ben@perpetualchesspod.com. And of course, last but not least, I'd like to give major thanks to the Perpetual Chess Patreon and PayPal supporters. Those who choose to join that community based on their level of support can do things like submit questions for guests of the show, have access to live Zoom Q&A lectures with grandmasters who often have appeared on the show, going over chess games, answering questions, stuff like that. And you can even get access to ad-free Perpetual Chess if that's your preference. So, but most of all, thanks to everyone for listening, and we will catch you all on the...
Podcast Network.
Judy was boring.
Hello.
Then Judy discovered ChumbaCasino.com.
It's my little escape.
Now Judy's the life of the party.
Oh, baby, mama's bringing home the bacon.
Whoa, take it easy, Judy. The Chumba life is for everybody. So go to ChumbaCasino.com and play over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. ChumbaCasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18+ terms and conditions apply. See website for details.